Hi, everybody. My name is Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober by the grace of God and the power that, and the community and the friends and the family and the unity that I found at Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that I'm incredibly grateful. I am from Las Vegas, and my home group is Connect the Dots. If you guys ever find yourself in Las Vegas, we meet on Monday nights and Tuesday nights and Wednesday nights and Friday nights and Sunday mornings, because we do everything alcoholically. So come hang out with us. I do like to drink. I had my first drink when I was about 9 years old. I didn't realize that there was anything wrong with me. I just thought I was this awkward, uptight kid. I came from a broken home. This is where you feel sorry for me. My parents divorced when I was 2 years old, and when my dad left, he didn't just leave the family. He moved from the town that we lived in. He moved 200 miles south. I grew up in the north of England in a city called Leeds, and he moved from Leeds to London when I was two, and then from London he moved to Toronto, Canada, and then from Canada he moved to California, and I hated my dad. I hated my dad for leaving. I hated my dad because he turned our family upside down. I hated my dad because when I grew up, I grew up in a Jewish home, and I grew up in the middle of a middle-class Jewish neighborhood, and when he left, we moved to a non-Jewish neighborhood. It was very anti-Semitic. It was a Section 8 housing. We became a welfare family on food stamps, and that was all my dad's fault, and I hated my dad. And if you'd have asked me while I was drinking why I drank so much, I'd have told you it was my dad's fault. If that son of a bitch would have stayed around, I wouldn't have turned out the way I turned out. I hated him. And I hated my mom, too. My mom was a screamer and a yeller, and she was no fun to live with. And I just hated my childhood. I hated my mom. I hated my dad. I hated my brother. My brother was 2 years older than me, and he decided he was going to try and be some kind of a parental figure, and I hated my brother. I hated my grandparents. I did. I hated those people. I hated my neighbors. I didn't know you at the time, but if I did, I would have hated you too. And I'm 9 years old, and I have this first drink with this kid, Barry. Barry was 2 years older than me. I was 9, he was 11, and because he was 2 years older than me, that made him cool. When you're 9, all it takes for someone to be cool is for them to be 11. And I'd have done anything Barry wanted to do. And in hindsight, I'm kind of grateful what he wanted to do was drink, right? Because who knows what direction my life might have taken. But he did. He wanted to drink. And we had a drink of Old English apple cider. It's apple juice with a kick. And we were in the wooded area behind this liquor store. He took a big drink on this bottle and handed it to me, and I took a big drink on the bottle, and what was going to happen next was going to happen almost every time I drank from that day until the day I took my last drink. I took a big pull on that bottle, and I puked out of my nose, because I'm a nose puker. I'm not very good at drinking. Some of you are really good at it, right? You're the carry the warm vodka in your back pocket under the seat of your car kind of people. You're the ones that when you drink, you dance better and you talk to the opposite sex better. And if you're a musician, you play music better. If you shoot pool, you shoot pool better. And God help us all, some of you drive better when you're drinking. I'm not that guy. I'm actually a pee on the couch, hit on your mom kind of drunk. I came to one time from a party. I'd passed out in this guy's living room, and when I came to, him and his wife were there staring at me, and as I opened my eyes, the wife got this look of disgust as I'd seen many times before, and she left the room, and I said, "What happened?" And he said, "You don't remember?" And I said, "No." He said, "Last night you got drunk and you peed on our couch and you hit on her mom." The book says that when we drink, we're often dangerously and disgustingly antisocial. Some of you are dangerous. I'm just disgusting is all I am. Uh, Oh, boy, but I love to drink, and I got in a lot of trouble, and I burned my life to the ground. I was 21 years old. I was a fairground pitchman. I sold Ginsu knives at state and county fairs. But wait, there's more. I got really lucky, and I ended up the national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances. I was on QVC, and I had infomercials, and I'm like Bill Wilson. I had arrived. I'm 21 years old, and I'm the youngest executive for this company. And you would think that if the reasons that I drank were true, the reasons that I drank was because I wasn't enough, the reasons that I drank was because my dad had left, the reasons that I drank was because I didn't measure up, the reasons that I drank was because I was this middle-class kid that was forced into Section 8 housing and then be a welfare kid, the reasons that I drank was because you didn't love me enough, the reasons that I drank was because I didn't feel like I measured up. You would think that when I got that job, you would think that that would have cured all of the things that I thought were wrong with me. Because I'm like, Wilson, I had arrived. But what really happened to me is that it felt emptier and it felt lonelier and I felt more like a fake and more like a fraud. And I drank harder at it. And I did all the things that we do more because of the emptiness and because of the difference and because of the inadequacy. And I felt squirmier and I felt more alone. And when they fired me from that job, I knew why they fired me. Because we always do, don't we? We always know why. It was this guy, Bernard. Bernard didn't like Jews. I feel bad for white Christians, because you guys don't have anyone to blame. Those of us in a minority, we always know who to blame. It's your fault, right? It's your fault. But when they fired me, they told me it was because they thought it was inappropriate to have an alcoholic crack addict as their national spokesperson, which I thought was a mild overreaction to the truth of the situation, but it was their world. I was just living in it, and I lost that job, and I got another job, and I lost that job, and I lost the next job, and the next thing you know, I'm in a 7-day detox in Stanton, California, and I'm living in a halfway house. And what happened next was the worst 3.5 years of my life. I was 25 years old, and I just couldn't stay sober. I wanted to be sober. I came to you, and I didn't want to drink no more. I'd burned my life to the ground. But every time I would get sober, something would happen to me that was bizarre that I didn't understand, because I knew that drinking was my problem. I knew that drinking was my problem. You could look at my life. You could see. You could connect the dots. It was obvious that every time I drank, I did more damage. Every time I drank, I burned my life to the ground. It was clear to everybody. Everyone kept telling me, just don't drink. You're a great guy. You're smart. You'll be able to figure it out. If you just don't drink, your life will make sense. It made sense that that was the truth. But I couldn't quit drinking because something happened to me that was a secret that I didn't know how to share with you. It was embarrassing. And the secret was this. Every time I quit drinking, something happened to me that I couldn't explain. But every time I quit drinking, I just started to feel empty and I started to feel alone. And there was this vacancy inside of me and this squirminess and this uncomfortability and this angst, and the world just seemed to get difficult. It's like the color ran out. It became dark and gray and black and white. And I tell you, I got this angst and this how do you say that, right? How do you come to AA and when somebody says to you, welcome back to the meetings, kid, how are you? How do you say, well, you know, I'm okay. I mean, I'm a little anxious, a little alone, a little afraid, not sure if you like me, not sure if I fit in. You know, I'm feeling a little worthless. I feel scummy and dirty and uncomfortable. But other than that, I'm okay. So I don't say that. I say, I'm fine, fine. Glad to be here. Work better, feel better, having a better time. And about a week into my sobriety, I can't take it no more, and I go and I get drunk again. And then I come back a week later, and then I can't take what it feels like. It's like AA's not good news. You guys say to me that if I was to come to AA, get a home group, get a sponsor, get involved, get some commitments, read this book, do these steps, start to sponsor guys, if I do all that, I'll be able to stay sober forever. Oh, no. I don't know if I can do that. And you say, don't worry. Because you know what, in AA, we stay sober one day at a time. And you say it like it's good news. My problem is that the way I feel in early sobriety is so uncomfortable. uncomfortable and so painful that when you say one day at a time, what it feels like is a prison sentence. I'm going to be able to stay sober one day at a time. One long, miserable day at a time. Forever, ever, ever. Someone tells me they're 60 years sober. I think you poor bastard, for God's sakes. Miserable for 60 years, one day at a time. Because I have no idea what it feels like to be active in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what it feels like to have made a connection with a power greater than myself. I have no idea what it feels like to be washed from the inside out, that is like what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I keep getting drunk and sober and drunk and sober and drunk and sober, and I'm doing what my sponsor called the AA waltz. 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. 1, 2, 3, drink. And I can't stay sober, and I can't stay sober. And on July 17th of 1996, I walked into an AA club more dead than alive, and I sat at the back of the room, and I didn't expect to stay sober. And if you'd have asked me what I was there for, I would have said, if I could have told the truth that I couldn't, I would have said, I'm here to rest. I'm just here to rest. I'll be drunk again soon if you'll just leave me alone, just give me some peace and quiet, maybe bring me a cup of coffee, buy me a hamburger, give me a cigarette. I'll be fine. I'm just here to rest. I'm going to drink again, and I don't know why, but I always drink again. It's always what happens. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do. And I met a guy. I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous at a noon meeting about a week into my sobriety, and he talked about something that I'd never heard before. But I know now in hindsight it had been said before, but I'd never heard it before. And what he talked about was, he talked about that his alcoholism began. He used this phrase that caught my attention. He said his alcoholism began where the bag and the bottle ended. That his alcoholism began when the drink wore off. That his alcoholism and what he suffered from really started in a state of abstinence. And that Alcoholics Anonymous, what we treat is a state of abstinence. And it's true, like Sharon said, you know, there is no don't drink step. You can't find anywhere in the big book where it says don't drink. I mean, AA works better if you're not drinking. We recommend it, right? But what we treat here is we treat that angst that I get when I'm not drinking. That we have this threefold disease. That this disease for me is that, first of all, when I start to drink, I can't stop. And the only thing that treats the phenomenon of craving is not drinking. But I'm not capable of not drinking. I got an obsession of the mind. I'm always thinking about drinking. In early sobriety, I'm either thinking, I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink, or I'm thinking, I'm not going to drink, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. But either way, what I'm thinking about is drinking. And the only thing that makes that go away is time. You have to sit through that. The problem is that I can't sit through that, and I can't not drink because of the third thing that happens, and that's that anxious apartness that Wilson talks about. That's that emptiness, that frustration, that grayness, that despair, that... And that's what we treat in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that weight on our soul that appears when we stop drinking. I don't believe in God. I can't believe in God. God doesn't exist to me. I grew up in a Jewish home. It's not really true. Really, I grew up in an atheist Jewish home. What that means is that we're Jews, but we know we're wrong. The only people on the planet more wrong than us are our crazy Christian neighbors. I just want to point out, some of you laughed at the Jew joke and didn't laugh at the Christian joke. You have work to do. Can't do my God, can't do your God, can't do it. Can't do it. Can't believe in God, don't believe in God, won't believe in God. My sponsor says to me, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. We don't find God in step two. What are you talking about? We don't find God in step two. We don't find God in step two. Don't find God in step three. How do you not find God in step two and not find God in step three? Of course you do. Step two, you come to believe. Step three, you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Of course you find God in step two and step three. No, you don't. You don't find God in step... What do you... Of course, yes, you do. It says it on the wall. It tells me to go ask the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I respect and that I love, how come they're sober? Well, I know already. It's like they hand it out on a card, right? You ask anybody sober, well, why are you sober? They're all going to say the same thing. I'm sober today because of a power greater than myself that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank God for AA and AA for God. I don't mean to goof on that, because if you ask me why I'm sober today, I will tell you I'm sober today because of a power greater than myself that I found in the room. And I would like to thank AA for God. Blah, 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 blah. But if God is what keeps us sober and you found God in step two or step three, here's a goofy question. Why would you do step four? I mean, it sucks. Step five is embarrassing. Six and seven, nobody understands. Eight and nine, very expensive. Why would you do them if you found God in two or three? Well, seriously, right? 10 and 11 is so confusing that half the people in this room think they're doing step 10 when they're really doing step 11. And step 12, I don't know about in Atlanta, but in Vegas, newcomers sometimes smell. I don't want to do that, right? I'm not interested. So I got to do this whole process if I'm going to find God, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and I didn't want to do step four, and I didn't want to do step five. My sponsor told me if I was going to stay sober and I was going to find this power, that I had to do that. That I had to be willing to put aside everything that I thought, all of my ideas, all of my opinions, everything I thought I knew about everything, and just lay aside prejudice, the book says. Step two asks that question. It says, do I now believe, which I didn't. I don't believe. I do not believe in God. Do I now? No, I do not believe in God. He asked for the question. He said, let's look at what it says on 47. Do I now believe? No. He said, well, it's a comma, not a period. Can we read the rest of the sentence? Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? Am I even willing to believe there might be a God? I don't know. Maybe, I suppose. I doubt it. It's unlikely. I mean, if you ask me, if you put a gun to my head and say, do I believe in God? I don't believe in God. But am I willing to believe that maybe it's possible, perhaps? There might be a God, maybe. No, yes, I don't know, maybe. It's possible. It's unlikely. I doubt it. But I suppose it's possible. And the book says, as soon as a man can say that he does believe or is even willing to believe in a power greater than himself, that we emphatically ensure him is on his way. What does that mean, emphatically? Yeah, baby, you're done. Step two, in the bag. It's over. So if you came here today and you hadn't done step two yet, guess what? We just did it. What's next? Say the prayer. Just say the goddamn prayer. Just knock it off. And then what? Write the list. Write the list. And if you're new and you've never done a four step or you're struggling with your four step, I can tell you that all of our four steps look the same. I know you think you're different and unique. I know you think yours is somehow worse than everybody else's. Or if you're like me, you don't think it's bad enough. That's the problem I have with my inventory, is I don't think I'm enough of a terrorist to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just pathetic. That's my big sin. But all of our lists look the same. We could write the first column for you. We don't, because it's fun to watch you squirm. First name on the list, Dad. Second name, Mom. Third name, fourth name, any siblings you have. Fifth name, current spouse or girlfriend. Sixth name, your boss. Seventh name, your former spouse or girlfriend. Next name, your boss before the boss you have now. And then it trickles down to anyone that's had any meaningless, pathetic influence in your worthless life to this day so far. And my list was no different. The first name on my list was my dad. And I hated my dad. My dad left when I was 2 years old and he ruined my life. And if you'd have asked me, I would have told you that everything bad that ever happened in my life was my dad's fault. My dad not only left, and he said this thing to me, goes, you know, I didn't really leave you kids. It was your mom that I left. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting, but I don't live in California. It feels geographically like you might have left me too. And I hated my dad. My dad was the first name on the list, and my sponsor has me write the first three columns. He was very kind. The next few columns, the next pieces of business, he had me do with him in my fifth step. And anybody that's brand new to the process, that's never done an inventory before, I do that with my guys too. It's very rare that we find an AA virgin anymore, isn't it? Like most of the people that we get to sponsor have been around AA before. And those guys, I have them write the entire inventory. But a guy that's brand new, like I was brand new, I do for them what my sponsor did for me. I have them only write those first three columns that are the example in the book, and we do the rest of it together. And he had me write this first column, and my dad was the first name. And why was I mad at my dad? Because he left and because he ruined my life. And what did that affect? It affected everything. It affected my self-esteem, my security, my emotional security, my financial security, my pride, my ambition. It made me afraid. It affected everything, and I hated my dad. My sponsor tried all of his spiritual mojo to try and get me to let my dad off the hook, because that was clearly his goal, but I wasn't hearing it. I wasn't letting my dad off the hook. There was absolutely no way. My dad ruined my life. He even whipped this one out of the bag. He even said to me, you know, maybe your dad did the best he could for you with the tools he had at his disposal. I said, get new tools. I was 2 years old, right? My dad left, and I hated my dad, and I wasn't willing to talk about my dad. My dad ruined my life, and I prized that resentment. I prized that anger towards him. It was my excuse, my reason. It was the thing that allowed me to be the guy that I was being. It allowed me to make all the mistakes. It allowed me to do all the damage. And if you'd have grown up with my dad, if you'd have grown up the way I grew up because my dad left, you'd have hated him too. And I wasn't going to talk about my dad, and my sponsor did the only thing he could do. And he kind of moved on to my mom. And we started to talk about my mom a little bit. Now, my mom was a screamer and a yeller. My mom, it was hard living in our home. I would come home from school or whatever, and I would grab the door handle of the house, and I never knew what my mom was going to be like. I never knew if she was going to be kind or angry. I never knew what her mood was going to be. I never knew what her reaction to me was going to be. I could have come home and been a well-behaved kid. I mean, I'm guessing that, because that never happened, right? Or I could have come home and I could have been in a lot of trouble, and you never knew what her reaction was going to be, and it was very difficult growing up in the house with my mom. And my mom was the next name on the list, and why I was mad at my mom because of the way she treated us kids, and what did that affect? It affected everything. My sponsor started to ask me some questions and talk about my mom in a way that I had never considered. He asked me what it might have been like to be my mom, what it might have been like to grow up in her shoes. The book asks a very strange question. It says, at the end of the three columns, it makes this statement. It says, we were prepared to look at things from an entirely different angle. You know, I had never looked at my mom's life from any angle other than the fact that she was my mom. I'd never considered that she had any other roles. I never considered she was anything other than that. My mom's job was to be my mom. I never thought about her as a young woman. I never thought about her as a three-dimensional person. I never considered what it might have been like for her to be a woman that was in this small community, divorced at a young age with two young kids. I never imagined what it would have been like for her to want to have some happiness, some joy, the difficulty she went through, the hardship she went through. I never considered that. So the book says this was our course. We realized that the people that offended us were perhaps spiritually sick, though we didn't like their symptoms, which is column two, or the way they disturbed us, which is column three. They, like ourselves, were sick too. They, like ourselves. How might I have been if I was in my mom's shoes? What might my behavior have been like if I was in my early 20s and I'd grown up in a small Jewish community in the north of England, and I'd gone to school, and I'd hung out with these folks, and then I'd gone through a divorce at a time where divorce was not popular. Divorce was something that was really looked down upon in the early 70s, especially in a small religious community. How might I have reacted if I was left alone with two young kids to raise these two boys? What What might I have been like? What might my temperament have been like? How afraid might I have been? And how would that fear might have made me act or react? I'm the kind of guy that stubs his toe, and everybody around me needs to suffer the pain. I had never spent a moment considering what it might have been like to be my mom. I just got angry and resentful because I didn't feel like she loved me enough. The book says that we asked ourselves, where were we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? Where was I selfish? I never imagined what it might have been like to be a young woman wanting to have some fun and some joy in life. I never imagined what it might have been like to be a young woman who saw a future ahead of her, and then the future was pulled out from beneath her. And now she's raising two kids. You know, this woman, who I didn't think loved me, went back into the community that she was raised in and went to the women that she went to high school with and asked them if she could become a domestic in their home and became a maid in these women's home, cleaning their kitchen floors and their bathrooms and toilets to try and give me and my brother a better life. Where was I dishonest? I imagine that she didn't really love us and she didn't want us and she resented us, when really what she did was sacrifice her entire life for us to have a better life. Where was I self-seeking? I just wanted the void to be filled. I just wanted to feel love, and I didn't really consider for a minute what it might have been like to be her. Where was I afraid? I was afraid I wasn't good enough to be loved by my mom, who, when I look at the way she sacrificed, she did nothing but love me. This didn't immediately make me and my mom close. But what it did was it created some cracks, some fractures, some breaks in the wall that I had built between me and my mom. It allowed me to see for a moment her in a three-dimensional way. It allowed me to stop the defensive judgment against her. And then in the later steps, in steps 8 and 9, it allowed me to rebuild a relationship with her. My mom and I have the best relationship today that we have ever had. It is not a perfect relationship, but it is the best relationship that her and I have ever had, because I had built a wall between us to defend I don't know what. Isn't that funny? Like, I don't even know what I'm defending myself from, but I feel like I need to defend myself because I am so afraid. I am so afraid that the voices in my head that I'm not enough might be right, that I have to protect myself from the noise. And so to protect myself, I had to blame my mom for things that she never did. I had to write stories and scripts that weren't true. Because this is what I do in my life. I don't know if you're like me. What I do is I get 10% of the information, and then I make up the rest. And I don't make up love stories and happily ever afters. I like to write action dramas at the end of which the hero dies. And the hero's name is Sheldon. And then my sponsor says, let's talk about your dad for a minute again. I don't want to talk about my dad. He said, let's talk about your dad for a minute. He said, let me ask you a question. You say your mom was difficult to live with. I said, yeah, she was difficult to live with. It was hard living in the house with her, very difficult living in the house with her. He said, let me ask you a question. He said, is it possible, and we don't know this, but is it possible that your mom had those behaviors and those characteristics, and maybe they were made worse and amplified when your dad split, but is it possible she had some of those characteristics before your dad split, and that maybe those were basic in her personality, the panic attacks and the anger and the uncomfortability and the fear that drove her? Is it possible that that was part of her characteristics? I don't know. You don't know. I don't know. How do you not know? I don't know. I wasn't there. Is it possible that your dad Is it possible that your dad married her quickly without really knowing her? I guess. I mean, in the 1970s, no, it wasn't the 70s, it was the 60s. I was born in 68. They were married in 64. In 1964, in the north of England, in a small Jewish community, people got married very quickly. In 1964, in England, there was still conscription. You were forced into the military to do service for 2 years, left over from the Second World War. And my dad was forced into the Air Force, and was very typical at that time that you were dating someone and you had to do your service and you got married very quickly. It was very common in that time. And they did get married very quickly. Is it possible that he found out when he came home from the Air Force that that person that he married wasn't someone that he could get along with, that he wasn't compatible, neither good nor bad to your mom? Doesn't matter if it's good nor bad, doesn't matter. But he came home into that community to be with this woman that he realized he wasn't compatible with. And he'd made a mistake in the person that he selected. Is that possible? I don't know. I suppose. I'd never considered it. You know that? I'd never even imagined or thought what it might have been like to be my dad. I'd never imagined or thought what it would be like to be my mom. They weren't three-dimensional people. They were roles. They were characters. They were mom and dad. They didn't have anything else in their life. They weren't multidimensional. Their job, their only purpose was to raise me. They weren't real people. They were mom and dad. I'd never considered them to be anything else. Is it possible that your dad found himself in a marriage that he wasn't happy in? I suppose. Is it possible that he didn't get along with your mom? I suppose. If you found yourself in an unhappy situation with a woman that you weren't happy with, what might you have done? I don't know. I will tell you this. When I was 16 years old, I graduated high school, not because I'm smart, because that's when you graduated in England back in the early 80s. And I became an emancipated adult, and I couldn't stand living with my mom no more, so I joined the family business. Signed on to welfare. It's the way I was raised. And I got my own food stamps and got my own apartment and moved out of my mom's house because I couldn't stand to live with her no more. What might I have done if I was my dad? I don't know. It's possible that I might have come home and she might have told me she was pregnant with my older brother. And I might have said, well, good luck with that. And I might have laughed, because that's what I do. But he stayed, and he stayed as long as he could. Is it possible he stayed in a marriage where he wasn't happy, and he didn't see much of a future for himself, and he was uncomfortable, and he stayed as long as he could? And is it possible that he came home one day, and then she was pregnant with you, and he stayed as long as he could, until he couldn't stay no more? Is it possible? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You've hung your entire life on a set of facts that you swore you knew when we started this process. It turns out I don't know nothing. I don't know. I don't know. What would you have done if you were your dad? I don't know. I don't know. Where were you selfish? Where was I selfish with my dad? What did I want my dad to do? I wanted my dad in his late 20s to sacrifice, early 30s to sacrifice his entire future. I wanted my dad to have no happiness. I didn't care if my dad ever had any joy ever again. I didn't care if my dad was miserable for the rest of his life. I didn't give a crap about my dad or what my dad wanted or what my dad felt. I didn't care if he ever laughed or smiled again. In fact, if he was going to be miserable, I wanted him to pay. And I wanted him to stay in that house and raise those kids no matter how it felt to him. I didn't care for a minute what my dad felt like. I didn't care. Where was I dishonest? I'll come back to that. Where was I self-seeking? I just wanted to have that storybook life that Hollywood paints the picture of. I just wanted what I wanted, and I thought I was being punished because I couldn't have it. And I was willing to do whatever it could and make everybody around me pay so I could have it. Where was I afraid? I was afraid that I didn't measure up. Truth is that secretly I believed that if I was a good enough kid, my dad would have stayed. Secretly, I believe that because I'd already believed somewhere along the way, I'd gotten the message somewhere between 0 and 28 when I got sober, and I don't know who gave me the message. Nobody gave me the message. But somewhere along the line, I made the decision that I wasn't enough and that I was broken and that everything was my fault. And somewhere along the line, I decided that if I was a good enough person, a good enough kid, a sweet enough kid, my dad would have stayed. And I was afraid that I wasn't enough even for a mother and father to love. And I don't know where I got the message because nobody gave it to me. My mom sacrificed her whole life to try and raise us kids. She gave everything she could, but I couldn't see it. I couldn't feel her love, even though her love was abundant. Where was I dishonest with my dad? If you were to ask me, I would tell you that my dad ruined my life. I would tell you that everything bad in my life is because my dad left when I was 2 years old. Ruined my life. I got a pretty good life. I do. There's some drama in my life right now that maybe we'll talk about, maybe we won't. It all depends on if God moves me that way. But there's some drama in my life right now. But I got a pretty good life. You know, I got a beautiful son. This kid is the center of my universe. We are very, very close. We talk at least once a day, sometimes twice. He is an amazing, bright, wonderful child. I love my son. I have my own business. It's a good business. We're struggling a little bit, ups and downs. It's just the nature of business. But I'm blessed to have that business, and I love the people that work for me, and I've got great people that work for me. And I've got amazing friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, amazing friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. until recently, I was married to a fantastic, wonderful, bright woman. And we're going through a separation and a divorce right now. But we had a great run. We had an amazing run. And I have this great life. And some of you are thinking, you know, if I ask the question, why do you think I have this great life? Some of you are thinking it's because of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And you'd be right. But I'll tell you the real reason why I have this great life is because my dad left when I was 2 years old. See, I live in Las Vegas, Nevada. Had my dad not left when I was 2 years old, and he'd have stayed in that house where I wanted him to stay, I'd have been raised in a small little town in the north of England called Leeds. Leeds is a great little town. I'd have been a market worker. I'd have been working at the local market selling curtains or something. I would rather have sold Venetian blinds, but then you couldn't say to people, we're out of Venetian blinds, it's curtains for you. That's terrible, isn't it? That's terrible. But I'd have been in this small town in the north of England, and I tell you, it might have been a good life, but I wouldn't have the business I have now, and I love my business. I might have a son. He may be a great son. I don't know. But my son is wonderful because he's half me and half my soon-to-be ex. And that combination of the two of us has created a wonderful, special, magical child. And I wouldn't have that child. He may be a good child. I may have a child. I may not. And he may be a good child. But he wouldn't be that child. He wouldn't be that child because I would never have met my wife. I might have a business, it wouldn't be my business. I might be sober, I might not be. I would tell you that I might not be because I think I'm sober today because I met the people I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I met my sponsor, and maybe God would have given me a different sponsor and a different group of people. But I love my group of people and I love my sponsor. It would be different. It wouldn't be this life. It wouldn't be this amazing life. It might be a good life, but not this life. I moved to Las Vegas because I went to California to be with my dad, and my dad and I had more problems. Right, because that's what happens in long-term relationships. I love what, what Bob was talking about and Linda were talking about, the difficulty of long-term relationships. I had this long-term primary relationship with my dad that continued to be difficult, and I ran away to Las Vegas. If my dad and I's relationship hadn't continued to be difficult, I never would have run to Las Vegas. Because I ran to Las Vegas, I got sober in Las Vegas on July 17th of 1996, and you can trace that all the way back to one thing. My dad left when I was 2 years old. You want to know where I'm dishonest with my dad? I'll tell you, it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. But it was the foundation of everything wonderful in my life. Howard Politz talks about a golden thread that runs through our lives that we often miss. The golden thread that runs through our lives. We don't know why the things happen to us that happen to us, but they happen to us in God's life, in God's world, in God's universe. And I tell you, I can look back at my life and see everything that I ever thought was difficult, hard, and complicated, and I can see where the magic from that is, except for the stuff I'm going through now. I can't see that for the life of me. I told a friend the other day, I said, you know, I'm going to tell you a story about the end of 2017 and 2018. I'm going to tell you how God took some very difficult times and used them to create something wonderful and magical that I'm so grateful for. But I can't tell you the story now. We're going to have to wait till about 2021 for me to be able to... be able to look back and tell you, but God, but everything wonderful and magical in my life comes from that great tragedy that I would have told you was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but I couldn't see it at the time. But I start to let my dad off the hook. I start to allow my dad back in my life. But 10 years later, I'm in Las Vegas, and I'm married to this woman, and our son is born, and he's the only grandchild for my mother and my father, and they both end up living in Las Vegas, not together. Not together, but they both end up living in Las Vegas, and the two primary relationships in my life get repaired, and my mom and I are closer than we've ever been, and my dad and I are closer than we've ever been. And it's magical, and it's wonderful, and it's because of this journey in step four. I have this desperate desire that I can't seem to get over. This desperate desire to know everything, to have all the answers, to be able to solve the puzzle, to be able to finish the riddle. And I tell you, what makes that impossible for me is the thing that I don't so desperately don't want to be. My humanness. What I desire, what I crave, what I need is power. The power to answer the questions. The power to finish the puzzle. I have to know the unknowable. I have to be able to figure out the unfigureoutable. And so all of my resentments are me making up answers to questions I can't possibly have the answer to. Because I have been given a great gift by our Creator, the gift of humanity, the gift of brokenness, the gift of incompleteness, the gift that requires me to search for Him. Could you imagine if I had all the answers, if I knew everything, if I was driven pure, if I was infallible? The first thing I would do is I would stop looking for power. Lack of power is not a curse, it's a blessing. Lack of power isn't a curse. Lack of power isn't my punishment. Lack of power is the thing that makes me seek the power. When has been the most joy in my life? Those moments, those fleeting moments, those small moments where I have been connected to God. Those moments where I have felt Him. And I wish they were... I want to be the guy between the prayers. You know, I want to be the guy that I sound like at AA meetings. Like, you know, I'm just in love with God and He's in love with me. Right? And some of you are like that. Some of you are plugged in, turned on, lit up like freaking Christmas trees, right? I hate you. I'm more like the Christmas tree where the bulbs flash, right? But not very often. Right? Like flash. slicker. But as I go through this process in step four and I start to realize that what I really am is a guy that's seeking answers to unanswerable questions that creates resentment, anger, separation, not just from you, but from me. And not just from me, but from the power. Wouldn't it be great if that was a lesson I could learn once? God. Thank God. Thank God. Really. I don't mean thank God. I mean thank God that our founders knew that I would learn that lesson, then forget it, then learn it, then forget it, then learn it, then forget it. That my spirituality, that my connection to this power is much like the tide of the ocean. I was in Fort Lauderdale one time with my wife. Her family was there, and we went there on vacation, and we were stood at the beach. And I had the strangest experience, and I don't know if this happens in Lauderdale a lot, at the beach down there a lot, but I had this experience there where the tide was so far out that because of some sand dunes, you couldn't see the ocean. You just couldn't see it. Sometimes I feel so connected to God. Sometimes I feel like I'm awash in His Spirit. Sometimes I feel like I'm drowning in the water of spirituality. And other times I feel like the tide is out. Like that day in Fort Lauderdale where the water was out beyond the sand dunes and I couldn't see it. Sometimes it laps at my toes. Sometimes it's up to my knees. Sometimes it's above my head. And sometimes the tide is out. And that day stood at the beach in Fort Lauderdale where I couldn't see the ocean. I tell you what, I never thought for a minute that someone had pulled the plug on the Atlantic Ocean and the water was gone. I knew the tide was coming back. And the longer I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more convinced I am that when the tide is out, that the water is coming back. That my spiritual connection ebbs and flows, and I don't need to be embarrassed by that. When I was early in sobriety, I was embarrassed to tell you the truth, that sometimes I believe wholeheartedly in God, and sometimes I am blocked from His Spirit, and sometimes I doubt. I was embarrassed to tell you. I stand here in front of you today, and I tell you I'm no longer embarrassed. To tell you that sometimes God fills my heart with the Spirit, and sometimes I feel like I'm alone. Sometimes I feel like I just hope that footsteps prayer is true. It's a great poem. So my dad and I become friends again, and I want to tell you, I want to finish the story a little bit for you. My dad comes back in my life, and he and I become very close. And he's living in Las Vegas. And we'd had a couple ups and downs. I got to Vegas because when I moved to California, I was 16 and 18. He threw me out because he didn't want me in his home because I was a drunk. And at 25, when I lost that job on TV, he was disgusted with me and wouldn't talk to me. And at 28... he threw me out of his house again because he'd let me move back in and I couldn't quit drinking and doing dope. And he threw me out of his house again, and that's why I moved to Vegas, because of another argument with him. Our relationship ebbed and flowed. It ebbed and flowed. That's what happens with primary relationships. It is so easy to forgive the people in your life you no longer have to have contact with. Right? Right? But some of our relationships are very difficult because we let them off the hook, we forgive them, we make amends to them as I made amends to my dad, but they're there again on Tuesday, and then Thursday, and then next Monday, and then Christmas, and then Thanksgiving, and then their birthday, and they're going to do something stupid again, and then we fight with them again, and they're sat with my dad. My dad moved to Vegas. He went back to England on vacation. He met a girl, or re-met a girl he'd known before. They fell in love, and he decided to move back to England again. Now, my son was 2 years old, and him and my dad were very, very close. My son was 2 years old, and him and my dad were very, very close. And my dad was leaving. Again. Again. I was a little unhappy. On his way out the door, he stuck me for $40,000. Now, he messaged me, that's one thing. Mess with my kid, that's another thing. You mess with my money? That's a whole different story. I was so angry. I was so mad at my dad. I hated my dad. I went back to my sponsor and I told him, I said, I am never talking to that man again. I am done. I will never talk to that man again. I hate that man. And you know what? It's your fault. It's your fault because you drove me back to him time after time after time. You made me make amends to that son of a bitch. It's your fault. I think you owe me the 40 grand. My sponsor said to me, if you never want to talk to your dad again, that's okay. That's okay. You don't have to. But you have to do it with open eyes. If you're going to write him off, you have to write him off with open eyes. You have to know what you're doing and what that means. And your dad's not young and he's old and he's probably going to die soon. Probably got, what, 5-10 years left at the most? And if you write him off and you punish him and he never talks to you again and he never talks to his grandson again, he never talks to his daughter-in-law again, and you write him off and you punish him, he'll probably feel guilty for about 5 years. He will be properly ashamed of himself, and then he will die. And you will have succeeded in punishing him for the last 5 years of his life. Congratulations. You, however, will live for probably another 40 years. And for 40 years, you will know that your father was a bad man, that the blood in your veins is his blood, and that you are just like him. And that you are no good because you come from no good people. You will know you weren't loved by the one man on the planet that was supposed to love you, because your own father, and you will suffer for that for 40 years. It will hurt you, and then you will die. Your son will live for about another 40 years, 80 years in total, and he will know because you'll make sure of it, because you will not suffer in silence. So you will make sure that your son knows that his grandfather was no good. You will make sure that he knows his grandfather didn't love him enough to stay in the country. You will make sure that he is well aware of all the pain and suffering that his grandfather caused his father, and that the Fetty men are no good and they're rotten sons of bitches, and then he will die. And you will have succeeded in your quest. By the way, he says, do you think you'll ever let your son down? I didn't know then what I know now. Do you think you'll ever let your son down? At the time, I said, I'm sure I will. At the time, I said, I'm sure I will. I didn't know then what I know now. He said, what lesson do you want to teach your son? Do you want to teach your son that when the Fetty men let their sons down, that when their fathers fall short, do you want to teach them that they write them off, that they excommunicate them, that they never talk to them again, that their fathers are disposable? Or do you want to teach them love and compassion? What do you want to teach your son? I was married for 20 years. Many of those years were fantastic and wonderful. And then, as sometimes happens in long-term relationships, you drift apart. And through no fault of hers, and perhaps no fault of mine, I don't know, but through no fault of hers, we drifted apart. And I believe that I couldn't have. But perhaps I should, I don't know what I should have, would have, could have. Could have, would have, should have. But perhaps it would have made sense for me to have ended the marriage before the marriage ended. But I didn't, and I stayed. And then I did what I swore I'd never do. And I broke my vow. And I disappointed my son. And I broke her heart. And I am guilty. And I did it. And I am... Could you imagine if I would have taught my son the other lesson? When I told my son what had happened in the marriage and I told him that I was sorry for the damage I was done, he said to me, my son is 17 years old. He said to me, "You've been a great father for the last 17 years, Dad, and one mistake doesn't change that. I love you." And I could have taught him the other lesson. I could have said to my sponsor, "I don't care. I'm not going to talk to that man. I'm not going to let him off the hook. I don't care." But instead, I took my sponsor's advice, and I went to my father, and I made amends to him, which is very difficult. How do you make amends to someone because they stole 40 grand from you? I get a phone call, my dad's sick and my dad's dying. And I fly back to England and I don't know what to say to my dad. And I don't know what to say to my dad. On the flight over, I'm in prayer and meditation and it comes to me. And I go to see my dad. I tell my dad, I tell him, "Pops," I said, "you know what, I want to let you know something." He goes, "What's that, kid?" I go, "I want to let you know that I'm glad that you are my father." He said, "What are you talking about? I was a lousy father." Which, you know, he's a smart guy. I mean, he was a lousy father. And if he didn't know, if he wasn't paying attention, I told him many times, "You're a lousy goddamn father." I said, "Dad, that's not what I mean. I want you to know, Dad, that I've grown into someone I'm proud of being. I want you to know I've become a man that I'm no longer ashamed to be me. And I am who I am because you're my father. People tell me I have a great sense of humor. People tell me that I've got some charisma. And I got to tell you, Pops, that's a gift of you. It's your sense of humor. You know, Mom, not that funny." "Not that funny. Great woman, not funny. That's a gift of you, Pops, because you're my dad, because your blood's in my veins. I'm a great salesman, Father. You've allowed, because you're my dad, partially because of your DNA and partially because of your training and tutelage when I was a kid, I've been able to have a great life for my family. Financially, we've done pretty well. I'm grateful for that, Dad. I am who I am because you're my father. I'm proud of who I am. Therefore, by extension, I am grateful you are my dad. I love you, and I am grateful that it is your blood and your DNA that pumps through my body. I am grateful you're my father. I love you." He put his head down, and he was crying, and when he put his head back up, he said this. He said, "I don't know what happens, kid. You know I'm dying, and I don't know what happens. I don't know if it's heaven or hell for me. I don't know if there's a judgment. I don't know if the lights go off and there's nothing next. I have no spiritual idea. But if I get to come back around this world one more time, I hope I come back the kind of man that you've grown into in Alcoholics Anonymous." And a little two-year-old boy was healed. I am no fool. If my father would have lived a few more years and he didn't, I held his hand as he died and left this planet. But I know that if my father had lived a few more years because of who he is and because of who I am, we would have had a few more fights. Right? But what is my job as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? My job is to protect and defend the relationships in my life. It is to protect the upswings, protect the good times, defend the good times. It is to shorten the bad times, forgive, Make amends. Let him off the hook. Stop demanding to be right. Stop making up the rest of the story. Stop imagining that I would have done different in their shoes. I wouldn't. When I do my inventory, I can see how flawed and broken I am. Allow them to be flawed and broken. Shorten the arguments. End the separation. Rejoin the family and the friends and the people on the planet so the separation can end. That's my job as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sandy Beach used to say that when something bad happens in our lives, what we're supposed to do is take a look at it. And we're supposed to ask ourselves, who's wrong? Was it me? Or was it them? If it was me, apologize. If it was them, forgive. My goal in my current situation in my life is simply this. I will not deny the things that I have done wrong. And I will try as much as I can not to defend those mistakes. I am flawed. I am broken. I am naked in front of you in the only place I have a shot of living. I'm one of God's kids, and God loves me, and God loves you, and I'm going to hope that I get to survive myself. Isn't that what we're all here to do? I hope I survive myself, and I hope you survive yourself more than that. I hope I can learn to forgive myself and you can learn to forgive yourself more than that. I hope I can learn to love myself and I hope that you can learn to love yourself. But until then, I will try and love you. And if you will try and love me, I will be grateful. Thank you for my life.